Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I'm John Boland, President Emeritus of KQED, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors, Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, James Poniewozik, Chief Television Critic of the New York Times and author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. James Poniewozik joined the New York Times in 2015 after spending 16 years as Time Magazine columnist as well as television and media critic. And at the Times, he has written about television as a reflection of changing culture and politics. In his new book, he says that television not only entertained us, but with the election of Donald Trump, it has conquered America. He argues that television has morphed from the three-network era of the 20th century, which joined millions of Americans in a shared monoculture, into today's zillion-channel, internet-atomized universe, which has sliced and diced us into fractious, alienated subcultures. Against that background, he offers a portrait of Donald Trump as the chameleonic celebrity who courted fame, achieved a mind meld with the media beast, and rode it to ultimate power. Today, we'll discuss Mr. Poniewozik's view that the age of Trump is a 24-hour TV production and that we live in an era where politics has become pop culture and vice versa. Please welcome James Poniewozik. So to get us started, I think many people have believed for a while that television has a lot to do with Donald Trump and vice versa. But I think a lot of us are not quite sure what we mean by that. And your book really illustrates just how symbiotic the relationship is between Trump and TV. That said, I worked in TV for a significant portion of my career, but I worked in public TV, and I don't watch cable news much if I can avoid it. I never caught the reality TV bug, and I've never watched worldwide wrestling. So for me, and the other sort of PBS, NPR, HBO types, your book is really a revelation not only about the making of Donald Trump, but also about the TV we don't watch, and the impacts, it impacts us regardless of whether we watch it or not. For those of us who woke up on the morning after the 2016 election and sort of said, what happened? Your book is one very interesting explanation. Born in 1946, Trump's life has paralleled the life of television in America. Tell us a little bit about how the early 1950s television shaped the boy Donald Trump.
As I describe it in the book, television is sort of like Donald Trump's invisible phantom twin. They were born at the same time, came out of the same era, had the same sensibilities, and kind of grew up together and evolved together. One of the first memories that Donald Trump shares in The Art of the Deal, his 1987 book. He doesn't talk that much about his childhood or his young life in it. But one of the only lengthy memories that he shares is of watching his mother watch TV. He writes about his mother, Marianne Trump, who was Scottish by birth, sitting in front of the TV all day, one day in, I believe it was 1953, when Donald Trump was about 7 years old, and watching the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. Now, obviously, this had a special significance to her because she was Scottish and all. But, he describes how she was captivated by the pageantry and the elegance of the event. And I think that what we are also seeing there is Donald Trump, like many children of his era, coming into this new understanding that didn't exist in America before, that there was suddenly this second space in American life. Suddenly, there was this box in the middle of your living room that contained this virtual world. It had the entire world in it, and it could bring, millions of people together at the same time into this virtual space, and it was like magic. He sort of contrasts here the difference between television and sort of his practical-minded father who was in the real estate business. And, you know, nobody's mom sits down for an entire day fascinated by the workings of a construction crane, right? You know, there is a special magic to this virtual space that TV creates, and I think that, you know, there is kind of a, if subconscious, realization there that if you can master that real estate, you know, that unreal estate of TV, you know, you can hold a position in prominence for millions of people. And I think that, you know, if you look at the TV of Donald Trump's youth, in many ways, it kind of prefigures the tone and the themes of, you know, what would be his campaign, which in many ways, his 2016 campaign was a campaign of cultural nostalgia, you know, and, you know, whether it's the, you know, sort of the patriarchy of Father Knows Best and all those 1950s sitcoms, or Davy Crockett punching out a congressman, you know, in an episode of Disney's Davy Crockett, you know, because there was, you know, literally a lot of Donald Trump's campaign was sort of nostalgia for violence. And, you know, this notion of, you know, back in the old days when we were strong and wise, we used to rough up protesters and, you know, and interestingly, professional wrestling, which was huge on TV in the 1950s. And little Donnie Trump had his favorite professional wrestler, and he would have an association with wrestling throughout his life when he was a casino operator in the 80s, and he would host WrestleMania at some of his properties in Atlantic City. When he actually went on to, you know, be on The Apprentice and became a character in the world of WWE wrestling, you know, doing skits and fighting Vince McMahon in a scripted fight on stage. And all this, you know, I think carried forward too in, you know, if you watch tapes of Donald Trump's political rallies, in a way, the theater of them is very much the theater of pro wrestling, the way he interacts with the crowd and builds on their energy and, you know, and feeds on it. So, you know, I think in that early stage of television, you can kind of see the kernel of this character that we would know as Donald Trump.
I wonder if he also took something from the coronation.
Yeah.
So reality TV seems to have convinced people that anyone can be famous, and it actually seems like everyone in the United States wants to be famous. How did Trump seem to have this longing for fame and celebrity long before reality TV? Where did that come from?
You know, I mean, to hear him tell it in his own narrative, or Tony Schwartz's narrative, who was his ghostwriter on The Art of the Deal, you know, when he talks about watching Queen Elizabeth's coronation with his mom, he sort of talks about that in terms of contrasting his mother's flair for grandeur with his father's nuts and bolts approach to business. And he would later say and tell biographers that, I decided to go into real estate, but I'm going to bring show business into real estate. And I think really his intuition, because, you know, if you just judge Donald Trump as a businessman, you know, his accomplishments would be nothing special. He wouldn't be in the top number 1, 2, 3, 100, 1,000 of, you know, American businessmen. What he was, you know, what he understood and what he was great at was the intuiting the sense that appearing like a flashy, successful businessman was as important or more important and powerful than actually being the greatest businessman. Because the seeming, surrounding yourself with all these signifiers of wealth, the supermodels, the, you know, gold plating, the weeping chandeliers of crystal, that created an image in people's mind that accrued to your brand, and you could leverage that into, you know, business and casinos and ultimately television fame and politics. You know, one reason I think that really that Donald Trump did so well on reality TV, and one reason he was cast in The Apprentice in the first place, is that reality TV is a form of television that relies on big broad strokes symbols, you know, and sort of faking a thing and making it seem real by, you know, playing on people's fantasies of what business is like or what a, you know, desert island is like on Survivor. So The Apprentice didn't need an actual businessman. It needed the idea of a businessman. And that was the entire point of Donald Trump. That's what he had been playing. You know, he was reality TV before reality TV existed.
Right. And you posit, and a number of other people have suggested, that in fact, the business, he's the business.
Yeah.
He's the brand, and all the business is a brand.
Yeah, exactly. And you can license that brand, you can leverage that brand, and a brand is a concept. You know, it is a virtual entity, the same way that, you know, TV and the media that he forged his character in is a virtual space. But in a heavily mediated culture, in a culture where you can be famous for being famous, and in a culture where attention is currency, you can ultimately leverage that into, you know, real money or real accomplishments or eventually real votes.
And I'm wondering if it was that contrived, because of course he was one of the original famous for being famous people. You know, he sort of paved the way for the Kardashians.
Yeah, I guess. Exactly.
And his striving for celebrity, when I was reading it, reminded me of that P.T. Barnum quote, "I don't care what they say about me as long as they spell my name right."
Yep.
Does that desire of his to always be the center of attention also somehow derive from the relationship with TV?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that he cultivated celebrity and attention, and, you know, TV through the 20th century became kind of the main channel to get that. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, one of his intuitions and the keys to whatever he accomplished was this notion that there's almost no such thing as bad publicity. Because, you know, whether you are the hero of the story or the heel of the story, you're the story. And that means that you can, you know, control, you know, you're the focus of the attention, you control the narrative, and everybody else is discussed in relation to you or what you're doing or how you're reacting to them. So there's definitely something both Barnum-esque and Kardashian-esque, you know, about, you know, how he understood the media.
You know, at the start of part two of the book, we learn about something I never heard of before, a very short-lived TV series with a character named Jim Profit. It is such a weird story. Tell us about Jim Profit and this TV show that didn't last very long. And I wonder if it would be a hit today.
Yeah, it was a show that was a little bit before its time. It was a drama, a sort of dark, satirical drama about business that aired on Fox in, I believe it was 1996, about this young man who comes out of Oklahoma, has this very sort of dark, abusive beginning. His father keeps him in a cardboard box where he, you know, that he watches TV all day through a hole cut in it, eventually escapes that life, goes off and ruthlessly crawls to power, rises to power through this business that the story of Profit is all about. He's one of the original anti-heroes of TV drama. He was sort of like a Tony Soprano or like Don Draper of Mad Men, sort of before these shows became popular and took off. And this show came along a little bit before the Sopranos kind of, you know, remade TV on HBO, and so it ran for four episodes on Fox and then was canceled. You know, TV at that point was not yet ready for the story of a fascinating, ruthless, amoral businessman whose entire worldview was shaped by television.
Right.
But eventually, spoiler alert, it would be.
And the strangest thing I found was that at the end of the day, he would leave his office and go home to his palatial home and go crawl back into the cardboard box.
And crawl up naked in the cardboard box. It's actually a fascinating show if you can still watch it on streaming or DVD. And honestly, seriously, if that had come out 10 years later, you know, that would have run for seven seasons on HBO or AMC, which is, you know, it's another example kind of how the business of TV kind of shapes the content of TV. You know, once you have places like HBO emerge, where you're appealing to a subscriber base that wants to see something different and something provocative, you can take more chances with your programming. And the reason I introduced that in the book, obviously, is, you know, what that is setting up is that setting up the emergence in the niche media environment of the 21st century of these anti-hero type figures, these charismatic villains or quasi-villains, Tony Soprano, Walter White on Breaking Bad, Don Draper in Mad Men, and a lot of the figures of reality TV who are, you know, they're not necessarily admirable. You wouldn't necessarily want your kids to be like them. But on the other hand, they're very charismatic and they're fascinating and they're brilliant and you can't stop watching them. And it creates a new kind of figure that, you know, didn't exist back in the old TV days of, you know, cowboy shows with good guys in white hats and bad guys in black hats, that creates a kind of archetype that a public personality can model themselves afterwards. Yeah. And, you know, that's another kind of powerful weapon in culture war.
Yeah, and actually, it really hit me when I got to the Tony Soprano part in the book, because I was a fan, and your writing made me focus on the fact that Tony was not a hero. Mm-hmm. He may have had some redeeming characteristics, but he just wasn't a good guy. And it was fascinating to think about the fact that those characters kind of paved the way for giving a politician permission among some part of the population to be an anti-hero.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should say, too, you know, I'm a fan. I'm not saying any of this to knock. You know, I think the Sopranos is one of the probably top five greatest dramas on TV. Breaking Bad was fantastic. You know, Mad Men was brilliant. And these were all shows that, you know, subtextually had a strong sense of morality. You know, David Chase, the creator of the Sopranos, you know, he knew that Tony Soprano was a bastard. And, you know, he would often sort of, you know, push against sort of the audience's embrace of him by driving Tony farther and farther into villainy as if a way to sort of, you know, challenge the audience and say, you know, see who you're rooting for, you know, see what this magic of TV is making you do. You know, Breaking Bad it's a show that bad is literally in the title, right? There's a morality baked in. It's like, it's saying this is a journey of a person toward evil. However, you know, these shows were brilliant art. One thing that, you know, great art and great storytelling does is that they don't march you to a conclusion. They're not like, you know, kids' fairy tales. They require you to think about them and draw conclusions. And one conclusion that a lot of people drew watching them was that Tony Soprano was awesome. And they just wanted to watch the version of the show where he beat his enemies and whacked people. And they didn't want to see, you know, Carmela Soprano challenging him about, you know, the morality of what he was doing, or Dr. Melfi trying to talk him out of it. There were people who thought that Walter White in Breaking Bad was like a model of masculinity and he was just a man trying to beat the system and, you know, provide for his family. And, you know, I think that also rhymes with a lot of our politics now. You know, again, you look, if I need to spell it out for you, like if you look at Donald Trump's campaign, a lot of the themes of that was, we are in, you know, as he would put it in his rallies, we're living in medieval times. You know, this is a horrible, nasty world. Terrorists are trying to kill you. People are coming over the border trying to steal your jobs and ruin your lives and change your culture. And who cares if the president is a nice guy? You know, you want to vote for the person who gets the job done. That is basically saying, you know, I am the anti-hero that you can root for in this story.
And I guess based on The Apprentice, that was very conscious. It wasn't just something that happened or that paved the way. Talk a bit about The Apprentice and the start of it and the way in which I guess he was an anti-hero.
Oh, absolutely.
In that program. He was the Tony Soprano of the corporate world.
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the way that the narrative of my book goes. And I think one thing that's important to remember about a lot of reality TV shows is that they sort of popularized the figure of the anti-hero for an even larger audience. You know, shows like Survivor on CBS and The Apprentice in its earlier years were, you know, huge TV hits for the TV of the time. And Survivor, when it debuted on CBS, had sort of one of reality TV's first massive anti-heroes, which was, I don't know if we have any Survivor fans in the audience, but his character in the first season, Richard Hatch, who was one of the competitors, who basically lied and cheated and backstabbed his way through the whole season. And the producers, when they were shooting that first season, thought that this was a disaster. They thought, you know, if the worst thing that would happen would be for Richard Hatch to win and be voted, you know, the final Survivor and win $1 million at the end of the season, which he did. And audiences loved it. They ate it up, you know, and it had the 50 million people watched the finale. And the producer of Survivor, Mark Burnett, a few years later, goes out and decides, I want to create a version of Survivor in the business world that would be The Apprentice. And when he is casting somebody to preside as the host of The Apprentice, you know, as I was saying, you want somebody who is, you know, not necessarily some boring, actual, dry businessman success. You want somebody who has been playing the character of a businessman and knows how to play that on TV. So, you know, that was Donald Trump. And the persona, I mean, this was already part of Donald Trump's public persona from the 80s. But what it really plays up for him is, you know, Donald Trump the shark. Donald Trump the decisive, tough guy. You know, Donald Trump the guy who, you know, may not be polite, maybe blunt, maybe mean, but, you know, he, you know, when he tells somebody they're fired, they deserved it and they had it coming, right? And again, this makes him into a huge pop hit. He's got a catchphrase, which is like the highest accomplishment in television. He's like Bart Simpson, you know, you're fired. And this, you know, basically brings out and encourages him to play to a side of his personality, which gets him rewarded on television, which is, you know, Donald Trump the fighter, Donald Trump the brash, you know, sort of obnoxious, braggadocious boss. And that is absolutely a version of the anti-hero the same way that Tony Soprano is. It's, you know, the tough guy who gets the job done in a cruel world.
And I guess the serendipity or luck or whether Burnett had this plan, but Trump got to go on TV and play the character he had been playing in real life.
He brought his own props,
yeah.
You know. He had a helicopter with his name on the side of it. It's like, you know, no, seriously, like literally, you know, part of the production of reality TV is like, reality TV is basically, it's like a postmodern expression of reality, which is like, you know, you're collecting symbols and signifiers of a thing that quickly give your audience the visual idea, you know, this is what business looks like. It's a big, you know, boardroom with a long table where people are sitting around and making decisions. You know, Survivor, again, plays on a lot of nature imagery and stuff like that. And Donald Trump, like, you know, whatever failures he had in business, was a tremendous success at collecting the signifiers and symbols of business success and wealth. You know, things, you know, it was no accident that whenever he built a building or, you know, got an airplane, he would slap his name on it in, you know, 50-foot tall letters, you know, because the name is the product. And he sort of licensed that product to Mark Burnett, who then applied the magic of professional TV production to burnishing Donald Trump's image, because he was very invested in making Donald Trump, you know, appear the most legitimate businessman possible, in order that should accrue to the legitimacy of The Apprentice.
And do you know, did Burnett have him in mind, or did it just sort of happened that, how did he have this lucky break?
Well, the way Burnett tells it, he was a fan of the art of the deal from early on when Burnett was kind of trying to break into the entertainment business. And I think that may have been half true and kind of half trying to flatter Donald Trump and getting him to agree to do the show. But, you know, interestingly enough, part of the backstory of The Apprentice is that once Survivor was a big hit, they would hold the finale episodes live at some location. And for the fourth season, they did it in Central Park in New York. I was actually there covering it as a TV critic. And they set up this fake tiki lounge Survivor finale stage on Woolman Rink in Central Park, which had been renovated in the mid-1980s by the Trump Organization. What happens when Donald Trump renovates a skating rink. He slaps his name up on it in giant, massive letters all around there. And Mark Burnett is, you know, on stage or backstage looking at Trump all over the place. And, you know, he thinks, that guy who used to be Donald Trump back in the 1980s, he would be perfect for it. That may have been the most politically influential TV reality finale held on a skating rink in history.
How many people watched The Apprentice, ever saw an episode of it? So a small number.
All right. I think it's actually more than I would have expected. Yeah. I'm proud of you people.
But I think it's hard for people who didn't watch the program to realize that Donald Trump was on TV a lot long before he ran for president, both on Fox and on The Apprentice. Talk a little bit about his TV career. And the way in which that led up to the election.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, The Apprentice was a tremendous hit its first season, and then, like a lot of TV hits and TV personalities, it got overexposed and the ratings dropped off. But partly because, you know, reality TV shows tend to be cheaper to produce than scripted dramas, it was a good enough business and ratings success to stay on NBC for 14 seasons. And there's a term that psychologists use for the relationship that people develop with TV personalities when they see them every week. I think it's a parasocial bond. And basically, what that talks about is the fact that people's, you know, brains, because we are evolved to develop attachments to faces that we see all the time. Our brains are not trained to distinguish mediated images from real images. So you form the same kind of sense of familiarity from somebody you see in your living room every week as you do with somebody that you see in your real life all the time. So, you know, there becomes this sort of comfort level and familiarity with Donald Trump. So, you know, that's part one of the puzzle. Number two, you know, Donald Trump, as now a TV celebrity, is doing far more. In addition to launching Trump Steaks and Trump University and Trump Water and all these various brand extensions / scams that he had going on at the time, is doing a tremendous amount of publicity. And one of the most remunerative in the long term publicity arrangement he gets is that Fox News asks him to start coming on Fox and Friends, its morning news / entertainment show, at the time that he's doing the Celebrity Apprentice, for a weekly segment called Mondays with Trump. And even if you watched The Apprentice, even if you watched a lot of TV, I was even barely conscious of this as somebody who covers, you know, TV and TV news, but he was, for 4 years before he ran for president, a weekly presence on one of Fox News's most popular shows, forging this bond with its audience, which at that point had basically become the, you know, driving engine of the Republican Party, the base of the Republican Party. And he would come on and he would talk at first about, you know, why he had fired Lil Jon or you know, Gary Busey on the previous night's Celebrity Apprentice. And then, what do you think about the Obama administration's policy in Libya? You know, what do you think about, you know, the BP oil spill or whatever? And slowly over time, this sort of quasi-news, quasi-entertainment program, you know, ports him over from the world of celebrity into the world of politics. And the audience really attaches to him in a lot of ways and suddenly sees him as a legitimate public spokesman for, you know, conservatism. And in a way, by the way, more legitimate to them than a lot of Republican politicians, because as a, you know, Fox News devotee himself, you know, he sort of wholly embraces a lot of the red meat messages of, you know, Fox News and far-right conservatism at the time, including the birther, you know, smear, which he embraces right around the time that he is becoming a Fox News personality. And far from disgracing him, as it did to much of the rest of the world after President Obama produced his actual birth certificate, it sort of tightened his bond with that base audience, because it's a way of saying, like, you know, I'm one of you. I believe even that, you know, that crazy stuff. I'm not like John McCain or Mitt Romney kind of playing footsie with, you know, the base, but, you know, kind of holding them at a distance. Like I'm in the family, you know? And people talk about The Apprentice electing Donald Trump. I honestly think that, you know, he could not have done it without Fox News.
Yeah. And I think that this is one of the revealing things in the book, is that we didn't just wake up one morning and suddenly he was president. You know, The Sopranos were on for 9 years on HBO. He was on 14 years on a network television program, and then became legitimized as a expert in public affairs by being on Fox News, at least. So he was basically set up for this with a large segment of the population.
Yeah, you can say this is basically, you know, a 15, if not a 35-year campaign rollout.
I came away with the idea that 1995 was the beginning of the end of mass media from the book, and I sort of agree with that. Mm. Please talk a little bit about the forces that were driving that change, that the going of the end of the, you know, the four channels and the fracturing of the country that also contributes to the political.
Yeah, I'll try not to get too TV nerdy about this for a lay audience, but the book that I wrote here is, it's half about Donald Trump, but it is half about the media environment that made him, that he adapted himself to. And the subtitle is Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. And a big part of the fracturing of America part is how television changed from a mass medium to a niche medium, and what this means, how this has the effect of changing the culture. I start sort of the main narrative of the book in 1980, when he's making his first national TV appearance on the Today Show. And that's an important moment for me, because that's just before the sort of infancy of cable TV. CNN has launched maybe a month before. MTV will start the following year. And what that changes is, in the three network era, when you have just NBC, CBS, ABC, I mean, you've also got PBS,
and PBS.
I have to say, you know, and it's PBS for, you know, the fancy people. But for real Americans, you got three networks. And what that means is that everything that's on TV has to appeal to these massive audiences of tens of millions of people. Like a bad rated show got like 20 million people, which would be an insane hit today.
Right.
And that has the business effects and content effects. It means that things that you put on TV have to be sort of broadly, mildly appealing, because you're trying to provide a little something for everybody and not give people reasons to change the channel. As that audience gets sliced and diced into smaller and smaller pieces, first by basic cable, and then by pay cable, and then by the internet and social media, where everybody has a personalized feed, what you get is niche audiences who are intensely interested in certain things and want to see things that are not for everybody. And they want to see kinds of personalities that are, you know, maybe not appealing to everybody. And that makes possible the rise of reality TV. It makes possible the rise of the TV antihero. It makes possible, you know, first cable news, and then specifically political cable news like Roger Ailes created on Fox News, where he realized he could apply the principles of political base building to, you know, a TV, which had the same sort of reward structure in many ways. And without that, you couldn't really have a figure like Donald Trump emerge straight from television and go into a successful political campaign. You needed this atmosphere that he's operating in to change in order to do it. And part of the story I'm trying to tell is how long-term that changed, and it changed America.
And it really, I mean, saying he lucked out would be the wrong way to put it.
No, that's a decent way of putting it. Good timing.
But just think it. Without Tony Soprano, without Roger Ailes, without the Survivor, all of these elements played together.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's partly why I wrote the book as a chronological narrative. It really is a chain of things. You know, without this, you know, you wouldn't have that. Without this, you wouldn't have that. And you know, without Donald Trump becoming a tabloid star, without him becoming, you know, a talk show star, then you don't have Donald Trump on The Apprentice, then you don't have Donald Trump on Fox, and then you don't have Donald Trump in the White House.
since we're
sorry to be the one to tell it to you, but
it's TV's fault.
And by the way, I would say, you know, there's always a push-pull to it too, because it's not necessarily, you know, TV just making people want certain things, but, you know, in the case of, like, if we're talking about, you know, Fox News and, you know, its base, it's also TV giving this audience the things that it wants, you know, so there's fault on all sides there.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
Interesting question from our audience, since we're talking about Fox News. What is the future of Fox News? Will it continue to be successful post-Donald Trump?
Yes, is the short answer. I mean, is my guess. You know, there you can never know the unknowns. But the history of Fox News is the history of people saying that, oh, surely Fox News is done now because of one political change or another. You know, Fox News started off and it became the number one TV cable channel, cable news channel after 9/11, and it leans into its super patriotism. And, you know, then when the Bush administration, you know, sort of goes into decline around, you know, the WMD scandal and Hurricane Katrina, Fox News's ratings flag for a bit, and everybody says, oh, you know, when they elect a Democrat, you know, then that's going to be it for Fox News. You know, they're not going to be on top of the world anymore. Well, do they know that, you know, Barack Obama was like the best thing
that ever happened to Fox News? Yes.
Because if you're presenting the news and politics basically as a story of conflict and grievance where, you know, the other tribe is trying to take things away from your tribe, the best thing that you can have is an enemy. And if your argument has particular, you know, social and cultural and, you know, often like racial valences, the super best thing you can have is an enemy named Barack Hussein Obama, who you know, the Fox News's opinion hosts go into overdrive against, and then their ratings take off. And then he leaves office and Trump wins, and they're still doing very well. And, you know, whether Trump leaves office in 5 years or in, you know, 1 year, or you know, like next week, like they'll find a new story. They'll find something else to make you scared of and anxious about. You know, they're professionals at their job. Yeah. You know, so
two sort of related questions. Have you been invited to talk about the book on Fox?
I have not. And I, you know, I sort of question, you know, whether it would probably depend on, you know, the Fox show, whether I would do that. You know, they know where to reach me. They can call my publicist. The dream, of course, is that the book gets, you know, attacked by one of Fox's shows. That's one of, you know, the president's favorite programs. That Hannity mentions it, and then Donald Trump tweets about it. You know,
and because, then you're really,
because that's the way that you get Donald Trump to mention his book, is for one of his stories to talk about it. So we shall, fingers crossed.
And then one Trump question, which would be a tough one. Do you feel Trump is going to destroy himself by leaving office because he can't fail? If he sees impeachment happening, would he just quit?
I have a hard time seeing him doing that unless it becomes absolutely inevitable. I'm not sure I necessarily subscribe to the theory that, you know, Donald Trump never wanted to actually get elected, you know, although who knows, and that he would be glad to leave office. So much of his persona and his brand is, you know, Donald Trump, fighter guy who wins, that to sort of concede and leave office, I think would just be antithetical to his self-conception. If he does it, then he does it in the way that Roy Cohn taught him, you know, early on in the 70s, which is, you know, even if you lose, declare defeat and disparage your enemies and, you know, talk about how you were cheated and walk off that way. So, you know, I don't see that him, but if it happens, and this is a thing that I've been thinking about, especially lately with the impeachment inquiry going on, right? Because, you know, as we all know, if you follow the politics of it right now, what it seems like is that impeachment is more or less inevitable and conviction in the Senate seems more or less impossible given the polarization of politics and the fact that Republicans just won't defect. And, you know, Richard Nixon in his time didn't have Fox News, you know.
Right.
But if things change in that respect and things sort of start to turn against him, back during Watergate, right? It took Republican politicians going over to the White House and, like, I think famously, was it Barry Goldwater watching the Oval Office, right? And told Nixon, you know, Dick, it's over. You've got to resign. You can't survive this. There's not a Republican politician that can do that now because they are enthralled to Fox. They are, you know, they know that their reelection and not getting primary depends on the good graces of Fox News. It's going to have to be like Brian Kilmeade, you know, who goes on the air and says, you know, looks at the president on his favorite morning children's show and says, you know, Mr. President, for the good of America, you know, we're behind you, but it's time to step down. He would have to be the Barry Goldwater of our time.
I wrote down this question, and I can't remember exactly what I was reading in the book, but there's a reference to a TV show as a Catholic mass that caught my attention. Tell us about that.
The Apprentice, like a lot of reality TV, just as somebody who's watched reality TV, a lot of reality TV, often as a fan, not just, you know, for research, but it's very liturgical. It has a pattern that it repeats and familiar incantations that are repeated over and over again. You know, whether it's on Survivor, Jeff Probst saying, you know, the tribe has spoken, puts out somebody's flame and they're voted off the island. And that to me is very much like Catholic, like the mass has ended, you know, let us go in peace. and on The Apprentice, there is, you know, this sequence of introduction. And then you have, you know, the sort of the weekly text, you know, which is the challenge that the teams have to carry out. And then Donald Trump presents the homily. They bring him out and have him present some sort of canned piece of business wisdom. And then there's the judgment where, you know, it's like the day of tribulation and people throw themselves at the mercy of the Father and somebody is cast from the garden and then it's you're fired and then you come back next week and worship. Yeah.
And the book is not totally about TV because there's this thing called Twitter.
There is.
And what I didn't realize was that Trump played around with tweets, but then on July 6th, 2011, according to the book, he sent his first tweets as a politician. It almost seems like Twitter was, again, like reality TV, like all of this, was designed for him.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and he first used it. It was actually his Twitter account was first set up for him by his publisher when he had one of his, like, books, because at this point I think they were pretty much totally ghostwritten, but was coming out in 2009, and they set up a Twitter account. And in the beginning, there are these sort of anodyne, you know, celebrity tweets often written by a publicist, you know, watch me on Late Show with David Letterman tonight. And then, around 2011, maybe 2010, just before the whole sort of birther thing starts up with him, he suddenly goes into political, you know, all caps Twitter mode. One thing that strikes me, you made the comparison to, you know, Kim Kardashian, you know, earlier. People, celebrities who are very good on Twitter often are people like Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, celebrities who are very much engaged with sort of being their own publicists, you know, and like taking the reins and developing this sort of intermediated connection with their fans. Well, you know, one biographical fact that we know about Donald Trump was way back in the 80s, when he was cultivating the media and newspapers and New York media. He used to call reporters up and half disguise his voice and say he was John Barron, publicist for Donald Trump. And you know, there is nothing he enjoys more than as somebody who like craves the attention and approbation of the media than being his own publicist. And Twitter is like, you know, designed for a celebrity who wants to be his own publicist. Basically, you know, on Twitter, he can be John Barron all day.
There's a couple of questions from our audience about cable TV that I'll put together for you. One is, with all the competition among TV providers, what's the future of cable TV? But then also, what is the history of cable in terms of CNN and MTV? And what were the business conditions that made cable TV happen? And so I guess, how did it start and where is it going in this world of television going beyond the television, where video's available everywhere? Why did we have cable TV in the first place, and where's it going?
To start at the beginning, I mean, part of the reason that, you know, why the reason we just physically originally had cable TV was that, you know, it was originally a way of running television signals to areas where you could not necessarily get good over the air coverage, you know, in its very, very beginnings. Once you had enough wiring laid, you had the possibility to, you know, create networks that didn't have to go over the air or get licensed by the FCC and were carried, you know, physically through cables to houses and buildings across the country. And one interesting sort of sociological fact about this is that cable, because of the physical process of installing it, becomes more widely available in suburbs and sort of rural places than it does in cities. I mean, actually, I remember being in New York when, you know, parts of New York were still being wired for cable because it was more difficult. And so you have effects like, for instance, the early part of MTV is really, you know, aimed most of all at like suburban white kids. You know, even at a time when like rap is a very big force in music, because like that's where cable is in the 1980s. There's all these things where it's really like the technology and the business of TV determines the content of TV. You know, with cable news, once you have the ability to create something like Ted Turner did, which is TV on 24 hours a day, you have this question of, well, what do you fill up 24 hours with? You know, It's filling, you know, you have literally all the time in the world to fill up. And so what you do is, you know, a lot of that is, you know, speculation and sort of spectacle and people arguing with each other. And you have, you know, you create shows like Crossfire, which starts in like 1982. And one of its first hosts, Pat Buchanan, runs for president 10 years later and, you know, nearly defeats George H.W. Bush in the Republican primary and is sort of a proto-Trump in kind of a, you know, culture warrior who came from television kind of way. So those are sort of, you know, the effects of it. Now, cable is, you know, in the future facing, you know, I think where it goes is that it's facing possibly its own replacement or being superseded in the same way that it did to broadcast TV by streaming. You know, now we have the rise of Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, which changed the whole, you know, mechanics and habits of how people watch TV, because, you know, you can download a whole season of a series and watch it over a weekend in ways that we're still, you know, getting our hands on. But it's just, you know, just technically, it just changes the metabolism and the content of TV a lot when TV isn't just a thing that's on a piece of furniture in your living room, but it's, you know, you've got it, you know, this is a TV. You know, there are screens everywhere. And I think cable is probably on the verge of its own sea change with streaming coming along.
Yeah, and I think that I remember a program here at the Commonwealth Club, must be 20 years ago, when Brian Roberts, the president of Comcast, was speaking, and I actually asked him what happens. We were even talking about streaming then, as the internet overtakes cable television, and he said, he wasn't really worried about that because the main thing they wanted to do was own the pipe going into your house.
Yeah.
For whatever you were going to get.
And then Comcast bought NBC Universal, and then NBC Universal has a streaming platform launching next year.
Right. Part three of the book takes us nearly up to today, and I loved the bit about Trump and the little red light, and the idea that even at his rallies, he's not playing to the audience that's in the room. Talk about his relationship with the little red light.
That to me was just one of the most fast, compelling, and almost like sci-fi slash horror like metaphors of this whole thing. After Trump won, he did an interview with the Washington Post, and they were talking to him about the rallies. And he said something interesting to me, which was that at his rallies, he often wouldn't focus on the people in the crowd because it was easy enough to get the attention of the people of the crowd. If their energy was flagging, you just say, you know, build the wall, lock her up, whatever. And they just like, you know, respond. It was just like, you just give me your greatest hits. But he said, I was always concerned about the red, if he worried that his rally, you know, the cable networks might cut away from his rallies, I'd say something new to keep the red light on. And, you know, the red light is the little light on a live camera that means that it's on and that you're going out live to the network, you know? And it means that, like, you know, you are worthy of attention. You matter. And so much of his life and his campaign and really his presidency has been, you know, beyond connection to any, group of people or person or group of voters, has been like, you know, just winning the love and the affection and not being rejected by that red light that says you matter. Like when it turns off, it's kind of like you're dead, you know?
And now, does Fox still carry his rallies live, or does anyone?
Fox does, yes.
But there was a time when CNN was carrying them as well, and
there was a time when CNN would show his empty podium before he even started speaking at a rally, right? Because this was one reason why he, you know, earned so much free media during the 2016 campaign in a way that, you know, I think it was actually the New York Times that calculated the value of electronic media coverage that he got, you know, in advertising terms, and it was something like $6 billion, you know, worth, like more than twice all the rest of his opponents, Republican and Democratic combined. And, you know, part of the reason that he got that was that he was so much in sync with the imperative of cable news, right? Which, again, as I said, was give people something to pay attention to if something, even if something isn't happening. That's why you had, you know, CNN, which was then run by Jeff Zucker, the executive who brought The Apprentice to NBC, would do things like, you know, when a Malaysian Airlines jet disappeared in 2014, that suddenly became the top story on CNN for months, even when we didn't know anything about it, because, you know, it was this mystery and people could speculate on it and it was cheap and it kept people tuning in. Well, Donald Trump was a plane that crashed every day, right? Like, just the idea is it just creates the sense of excitement that people thrive on, or anxiety or fear or anger or hate. Like, even if you hated Donald Trump, that was a reason for people to tune in. And it was a reason to tune in even if he wasn't saying anything new, because the whole premise with him was, you know, freaking Donald Trump is running for president and anything could happen and he could say anything. And so it's news even if there's just an empty podium without a person in it and Donald Trump is about to speak. You know, so CNN doesn't do that anymore, but they still, you know, cover an awful lot of tweets that, you know, aren't necessarily news. Right. You know, carry an awful lot of, you know, presidential press conferences that, you know, they can't necessarily trust him to tell the truth at, you know, but they've learned lessons in a lot of ways. Like, for instance, there's a lot of more real-time fact-checking and things like that, trying to keep up with this fire hose of information. So, but some of it is kind of the more things change, the more they stay the same, you know.
Yeah, and actually that was back in that period was when Jeff Zucker made the unfortunate quote of, Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he's good for CNN.
Yeah, actually, that was Les Moonves of CBS. But Jeff Zucker was operating in the same spirit, certainly. I mean, you know, a lot of TV was.
Now the presidency is a TV show, and every day an episode is in which Trump defeats his enemies. Should we watch the show, or should we try to avoid it?
I mean, here's the thing. Number one, you sort of have to watch the show as an engaged citizen because, you know, he is the president. You know, he can launch the nuclear missiles if he wants to. You know, things that he says or does, you know, matter. You know, even if not everyone, you know, matters, and even if they get covered sort of to excess or sensationalistically. But the other thing, and this point, this kind of abstract but important point I think I try to make toward the end of the book, is that even if you don't watch the show, even if you try to tune it out and not watch cable news and not look at your phone so much, not look at Twitter so much, you still live in the show. You still live in a world where, you know, what's going on in the news and, you know, the environment and the decisions that are being made that affect our lives are often driven by, you know, what Donald Trump has gotten worked up about, you know, during his like morning 5 hours of Fox News watching. You know, you live in a world whose metabolism is set by somebody who sort of thinks in tandem with the mindset of a live cable news channel. Like, that's the speed at which news goes on. Donald Trump's relation with television, dictates, you know, kind of the terms of the world that we live in, even if you do try to tune it out. So, you know, I think in a way that there is unfortunately no off switch in that sense.
One other thing, back to Fox News, this is something I've often wondered about, and you may have a theory about it. There are 350 plus million people in the United States,
yeah,
and less than 5 million of them watch Fox News. How does it have this outsized influence?
You know, it's sort of in the same way that, you know, a TV show can be a niche hit, you know, but its following is so intense, and, you know, its sort of cultural repercussions are so great that it has kind of an outsized impact. You know, in the same way that, you know, when The Sopranos was on, you know, not as many people were watching it as were watching, you know, Law and Order. But, you know, it arguably has a much greater cultural footprint and influence after the fact than, you know, something like Law and Order did. I mean, just to, you know, take an example. In the same way, you know, Fox News or any cable news channel, yeah, only has a few million people watching it at one time at best. But number one, it's going on 24 hours a day. You know, number two, Fox in particular, because it is a special breed of cable TV in that it has a particular political affiliation and tremendous influence in the Republican Party, because its viewership is so engaged and so much takes its cues from what Fox News' hosts are saying and is worked up about the, you know, kind of cultural warfare that Sean Hannity or, you know, back in the day, Glenn Beck or Tucker Carlson is promoting. It has a huge in real world influence in that, you know, that then becomes kind of the position of Republican politicians who don't want, you know, who don't want to get primaried out of office. So, you know, that's kind of, in a way, the story of niche media, you know, which kind of, you know, had an analogy to the way Donald Trump won the Republican primary in 2016, is that, you know, you can build from an intense small audience to have much greater cultural footprint.
And there was another section, another segment in the last part of the book that talked about Fox and Friends as Trump's magic mirror.
Yeah.
So take us through, what do you mean by a magic mirror, and why Fox and Friends?
So when I was a little kid, there was a show called Romper Room.
I remember that.
And they aired it like in different local markets, and there was a different local host. And I think it was always at the end of it. And I think the host was always a woman, at least the one that I watched in the Detroit area. She would look in her, like, what she called her magic mirror, which I think was like, it was just like a frame and she would pretend to see you at home, like the audience, you know. And, you know, and I see Nancy and Tommy, and, you know, sometimes she would say your name and you would get so excited, right? Because, like, that's the dream of, like, every little kid who sees TV for the first time and doesn't really understand it, that, like, you know, the people on the other side of that screen are aware of you as you are of it, right? Well, Donald Trump, who, like, watches Fox and Friends every morning, he's the one lucky child in all of history for whom that is actually true. The people on the other side of the screen are actually aware of him and talking directly to him and making a show for him, you know, to the point that, you know, they joked after he was elected that, you know, they could have Donald Trump flash the lights on and off in the White House if he was watching. And then they showed a live feed of the White House, which was actually a TV camera trick, but they had the lights flash on and off. But, you know, literally, like so much of, and therefore, you know, so much of what's going on in America today is influenced by this TV morning show, which I wrote it just as a little aside. I wrote a column about Fox and Friends in the New York Times shortly after Trump's election. I called it the most powerful TV show in America for exactly this reason. And as a way to kind of ding the New York Times, Fox and Friends took this quote and took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying, the most important TV show in America, the New York Times. By the way, that cost like six figures to take out an ad in the New York Times. I did not get a cut of that. I'm still resentful over it. And the host showed it on TV and joked about it. And then, you know, 3 minutes later, Donald Trump tweets out, congratulations to the great hosts at Fox and Friends, who the New York Times, you know, proving that, you know, magic mirror time had begun for the day again.
That's great. So if Donald Trump's presidency is a TV show, when is it over? Or does the show continue even after the presidency? As long as he's alive and after, does the show continue?
I mean, it's the show that never ends in the sense that, you know, a part of the book is that, yeah, this is a book about Donald Trump and Donald Trump, the TV character, and like how we got to the point where this guy from TV could become elected president, you know, solely through becoming a TV persona. But even if he had lost, you know, even if like 80,000 votes in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania had gone a different way in 2016, you know, all those factors that put him into office would still exist, you know, and this route would still exist. And this sort of, you know, just this metabolism and, you know, vitriolic atmosphere of the, you know, electronic news media would still exist. Like, all of that would have been in place if Donald Trump had not made it into the White House, and they will still be in place after he leaves the White House. Now, I think the second implicit half of that question is, you know, does America burn out on the show and you decide to turn it off? And I think in a way that's, you know, kind of partly the test of the 2020 election. You know, I think that you see in the Democratic primary, in the debates, it's kind of a meta debate of how do you counter-program Donald Trump? You know, if this, you know, is a contest that's being fought partly in the media, do you sort of give people, do you try to create a different kind of compelling, exciting program that has a different message but still grabs people's attention a different way? Or do you kind of advance kind of the I will let you turn your TV off America argument, right? Like the idea that, like, you just, if you elect me as president, I'll be boring and you can just stop looking at your phone first thing in the morning for at least another 4 years.
But what I could imagine is that if Donald Trump is not reelected in 2020, he'll probably have a show on.
Well, that's actually the third part of the question, right? Which is, you know, in a way, I sort of wonder if it would, I don't know that he would seek to like get his own show on Fox. I think that would be a come down for him. I could totally see him doing, as people posited that he might if he lost the 20, 2016 election, like most of the smart people thought that he was going to, trying to start a TV news network. You know, I think like he would love to run Fox
network.
Or to create a competitor to Fox. And I will say, just because of like a lot of the factors of, you know, how TV works and establishing a network works, I think for him to create a TV network that overtook Fox would be harder than getting elected president.
So we're running out of time. I saved this question from the audience until the end.
Oh, God.
So it's what you would expect. You're a TV critic. What's your least favorite and most favorite TV shows right now, and why?
Least favorite is almost hard to say because, you know, if I really, really despise something, I've probably, you know, turned it off at this point. I'll start with most favorite and think if I can think of a good answer for least favorite after that. But I think my most favorite right now is the Good Place on NBC, which people may or may not watch here. And partly because, you know, in this book, because of, you know, it's sort of its subject matter and a lot of it's about media and nonfiction TV, I'm talking about a lot of the more kind of negative and, you know, caustic aspects of TV. But I also try to make the point toward the end that, you know, this medium, this like nervous system of America, can bring across a lot of different messages. And there's not only one kind of story you can tell. And I think The Good Place is kind of an example of a different kind of story. It's a very funny comedy on TV, on NBC, about the afterlife. And I won't explain it too much for people who haven't watched it, but it's just a really funny sitcom. You should watch it. But it is it's grounded in the idea of there's this group of characters and they have to decide what it means to be a good person and what do you owe to other people in the world. And it's kind of a mini education in like the history of moral philosophy and, you know, Kantian morality and this and all the stuff that I learned about in college and forgot. And it's really like it's an example of using TV not to portray the world as, you know, us versus them, and in order for me to win, you gotta lose. But, you know, to say, you know, maybe there is actually a benefit to us all trying to be good and trying to acknowledge a responsibility to other people, and that is actually, you know, a better way. So, you know, I not only like laugh like hell watching it, it's something that like gives me a little bit of hope. So.
And is there something that we shouldn't watch, or?
Fox and Friends. I mean, Donald Trump watches it for you, so, you know.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time, so our thanks to James Poniewozik, chief television critic of the New York Times and author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of his book will be for sale, and he'll be pleased to sign them in the back of the room following the program. I'm John Boland, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.